I want us to lay some background for the book of Revelation so that we can understand what is found in this book. I want to read, first of all, from the 10th chapter of Revelation and verse 7. At this particular time, John has seen a mighty angel standing with one foot upon the sea and another upon the land. And he has just cried that there should be time no longer, according to the King James Version, or which in reality is no longer delay. And then says, "But in the days of the voice of the seventh angel, when he shall begin to sound, the mystery of God should be finished, as he hath declared to his servants the prophets." There is something revealed here in this passage that the prophets of old had declared. He calls it the mystery of God. When we consider the mystery of God, we're talking about that which is referred to in the New Testament scriptures. For example, the Apostle Paul, in the first chapter of Ephesians, in Ephesians chapter 3, in Colossians 1, and in other New Testament texts, talk about the mystery of God, which was kept secret since the world began, which was hid in God from ages. It was hidden from the apostles and from prophets, and it was hidden from princes. It was hidden from men throughout the ages. This mystery was revealed by the holy apostles and our holy prophets of old in the Old Testament scriptures. The Apostle Peter writes in 1 Peter chapter 1 of salvation. And he says, beginning in verse 9, "Receiving the end of your faith, even the salvation of your souls, of which salvation the prophets have inquired and searched diligently, who prophesied of the grace that should come unto you, searching what or what manner of time the Spirit of Christ which was in them did signify, when it testified beforehand the suffering of Christ and the glory that should follow, unto whom it was revealed that not unto themselves but unto us they did minister the things which are now reported unto you by them that have preached the gospel unto you with the Holy Ghost sent down from heaven, which things the angels desired to look into." Now that's 1 Peter 1, 9 through 12. And what he says in the passage is that the Old Testament prophets revealed things they didn't understand, but they understood that they were not for them. They were for us in a later time. Other New Testament passages talk about this, call it the mystery, and they tell us that this mystery has been revealed unto us in these days. For example, in Ephesians chapter 3, the Apostle Paul writes, "For this cause I, Paul, the prisoner of Jesus Christ for you Gentiles, if ye have heard of the dispensation of the grace of God, which is given me to you, how that by revelation he made known unto me the mystery, as I wrote afore in few words, whereby when you read, you may understand my knowledge in the mystery of Christ." You see, the Old Testament prophets prophesied of many things that would come to pass under the New Testament order. They prophesied of the coming of John the Baptist. They prophesied of the coming of Jesus Christ. And in fact, if you recall that just before Jesus ascended to heaven, he reminded his apostles of the fact that all things that were written in the prophets and in the Psalms had to be fulfilled concerning him. Here's what he said, Luke 24:44. "These are the words which I spake unto you while I was yet with you, that all things must be fulfilled, which were written in the law of Moses and in the prophets and in the Psalms concerning me." Those things were being fulfilled, and they had to be fulfilled. And there were other things in the Old Testament law that had to be fulfilled also. But what is said here in Revelation 10 and 7 is that when the seventh angel sounds his trumpet, it's all over. It's accomplished. It's been fulfilled. Let me read it again. "But in the days of the voice of the seventh angel, when he should begin to sound, the mystery of God should be finished, as he hath declared to his servants the prophets." All the Old Testament mysteries, all the Old Testament prophets will be fulfilled when this angel sounds his trumpet. In the 11th chapter and in verse 16 of the chapter, it says, "And the four and 28, backing up to verse 15. "And the seventh angel sounded, and there were great voices in heaven saying, the kingdoms of this world have become the kingdoms of our Lord and of his Christ, and he shall reign forever and ever. When the seventh angel sounded his trumpet, it was over. It was all accomplished. All the mystery of God, as revealed unto his servants, the prophet, had been fulfilled. Here's precisely the point, and I hope you understand this, that what he is saying here is that all that God intended for mankind, when these things were carried out, would have been fulfilled. All the purposes of God would have been made known, they would have been revealed unto mankind, and they have been accomplished as far as man's concerned. Which is to say, that when God fulfilled his promises in the destruction of the city of Jerusalem, all the purposes of God were full and complete. But you may raise the question, and I'm glad that you have it on your mind, and that is this: what does the destruction of Jerusalem have to do with the mysteries of God? Well, if you recall, back in Genesis chapter 12, the first three verses of the chapter, God called Abraham to go out from his country and from his father's house, and that if he would do that, that he would make of him a great nation, and in him would all the families of the earth be blessed. God promised two things to Abraham that are of absolute importance to you and I today. Number one, he would make of Abraham a great nation. Number two, that through him all families of the earth would be blessed. Abraham had one son. And Abraham and Sarah and Isaac do not make a nation. So he passed the same promise that he made to Abraham onto Isaac. And Isaac had two sons. And Isaac and Rebekah and their two sons do not make a nation. So God passed the promise on down to Jacob. Jacob was the son, or one of the sons, of Isaac. And God promised him that he'd make of him a great nation, and in thee shall all families of the earth be blessed. Abraham had 12 sons, and while that is hardly a nation, it's a good start, because those 12 sons married wives, and they began to have children. Now, you're familiar with the history of the Old Testament, I'm sure, how that there became some trying times during the last days of the life of Jacob. Because of that, through the providence of God, they went down into Egypt and dwelt in the land of Goshen. And that after being there for 215 years, they grew into a great and powerful nation. I don't know how large they were, but they had an army of 600,000. And that's a pretty good sized army. So they had grown to be a pretty good sized nation. And they were made slaves to the Egyptians. And they cried unto God, and God sent them a deliverer in the personage of Moses. And under the leadership of Moses, they left the land of Egypt, crossed the Red Sea, and traveled down the western side of the Sinai Peninsula till they came to Mount Sinai, where they received the law of Moses and the Ten Commandments around which the law of Moses was built. God had fulfilled his promise to make of Abraham a great nation. This was a great nation. And the law was given unto this nation of people to guide them and to direct them as a nation throughout their years of national inheritance. They traveled from there up through this region and came into this area here called Kadesh Barnea. And they sent out spies into the land to spy it out to see if they could take it, because God had promised them the land. And 10 of the spies that came back of the 12 brought back an evil report. Because of their unbelief in the power of God, that he could give them this land, they were caused to wander around here in this wilderness for a period of 40 years. After which, they journeyed from here around through this section upon the east side of the Dead Sea and conquered this section of country over here on the east side of the Jordan River, and encamped there at the northeastern end of the Dead Sea. And while they were there, Moses restated the law of Moses that was given. And in the restating of that law of Moses, he gave them some instructions that they needed to understand, and that you and I need to understand. If you'll turn with me to the book of Deuteronomy, to the 12th chapter, when it comes to verse 5, he says, "But unto the place which the Lord your God shall choose out of all of your tribes to put his name there, Even unto his habitation shall you seek, and thither shalt thou come. You notice that? In the place that God chooses to put his name there. That is, in the land of Canaan, when you go in to possess it. That's where you will, where you are to come and to offer your, verse 6, your burnt offerings, your sacrifices, your tithes, the heave offering of your hand, and your vows, the freewill offerings, and so on. Again, in verse 6 he says, ye shall not do after all the things that you do here this day, every man whatsoever is right in his own eyes. But in verse 10 he says, when you go over Jordan and dwell in the land which the Lord your God giveth you to inherit, and when he giveth you rest from all of your enemies round about, so that you dwell in safety, then there shall be a place which the Lord your God shall choose to cause his name to dwell there. Thither shall you bring all that I command you, and so on. And then in verse 13 and 14 he says, take heed to thyself, that thou offer not thy burnt offerings in every place that thou seest, but in the place which the Lord shall choose in one of his tribes, that there thou shalt offer thy burnt offerings, and there shalt thou do all that I command thee. So God instructed them that when they came into the land of Canaan, there would be a place chosen to cause his name to dwell there. His tabernacle would be placed there, and his temple would be there. They would bring all their burnt offerings and their sacrifices to that place. So, when we get into the land of Canaan, we find that God selects for them the places where they are to place his tabernacle and to offer their sacrifices before that altar. The first place that was selected was a place called Shiloh that was somewhere in this vicinity here, though it's not on this map. According to Jeremiah 7 and 12, Jeremiah wrote that the first place that God placed his name was at Shiloh. A little later, however, God selected the city of Jerusalem. This is the reason why that Jerusalem comes into prominence, is because that God selected to place his name there. You see, the tabernacle which had been built by Moses in the wilderness, for which the children of Israel were to worship God, was set up at Shiloh. But that grew old and decrepit, and the furniture became separated from it, and as a place of worship it declined. And there was a period of quite a number of years in which there was a question about where the children of Israel would worship. And in the days of David the king, he saw the disarray that the worship of God was in, and he decided that he was going to build an house, a temple for God. But the Lord would not permit him to build it. The reason God would not permit him to build the temple was because of the fact that he was a man of war. And God did not want David building his house. But David was permitted to make the preparation for the building of the house. And so David made the preparation, and then instructed his successor, Solomon, who was his son, to build the house for the Lord in order that his name might be there. Solomon carried out his wishes. He did precisely what God had instructed him to do, and he built the temple. A total of 7 years were involved in building the temple, and after the temple was built, Solomon gathered together the people, and they dedicated the temple of the Lord. And here is exactly what the Lord had to say, or rather what Solomon had to say, unto the people concerning Jerusalem, and concerning the selecting of this place where God had put his name. The statement is made as Solomon is speaking in verse 5. He says, since the day that I brought thee out forth out of the land of Egypt, this is God speaking, and he's referring back to what God had said earlier. He said, since the day that I brought forth my people out of the land of Egypt, I chose no city among all the tribes of Israel to build an house in, that my name might be there. Neither chose I any man to be a ruler over the people of Israel, but I have chosen Jerusalem that my name might be there. God said, I have chosen Jerusalem, and I've chosen it that my name might be there. If you will read the rest of that chapter, that 2 Chronicles 6, you will find that in the dedication of this temple, that God instructed that all prayers by the Israelites be directed toward Jerusalem, because this was the temple of God, the dwelling place of God. Not that he literally dwelled there, but that his worship was to be directed toward this place. So the city of Jerusalem became a prominent city because of the fact that it became the center of the worship of the nation of Israel, because their temple was placed there. Now God had said that this place is the place toward which you are to direct all of your offerings, your burnt offerings, your sacrifices, and all things that you do. They're to be directed toward this city. Now, back in Deuteronomy, as we back up a little bit in time and get the connection to the story, when the children of Israel were encamped at the northeast side of the Dead Sea before going over into the land of Canaan, Moses restated the law. When he comes to chapters 28 through 32, he begins to relay unto the people the message of God. It is a message of blessings and of curses. The blessings are conditional. If you obey my voice and keep my commandments, then there will be blessings. If you disobey me, there's going to be curses. And almost the entirety of four chapters are to be contributed to a study of the curses that would come upon them if they did not obey God's voice and keep His commandments. I think Deuteronomy 28 through 32 is one of the most remarkable passages of Scripture in the Bible, because God foretold 1,500 years of the history of the nation of Israel beforehand, contingent upon what they did. They rejected God, they refused to obey Him, and everything that God said would come to pass came to pass. And it's rather remarkable how that in this passage that God foretold that He would cause them to be carried away into captivities, that if they repented, they would be permitted to return, that He would restore them to their worship and to their service to Him, but that ultimately, in the latter end, they would have to suffer the consequences of punishment because of the fact that they had wandered away from God. Now, with that on our minds, we began to see the mystery. We began to see the unfolding here. In the Old Testament scripture, the nation of Israel under God was to be guided by the law of Moses. They were to keep it. If they disobeyed it, they'd have to suffer the consequences for it. When Jerusalem became the capital of the nation with the temple of the Lord there, this temple became, or rather this city became the one that bore the brunt of all the wrath and the doom and the warnings that God directed against them. The prophets come upon the scene. The reason the prophets come upon the scene is to warn God's people of what He had said He would do with them unless they repented. Time and time again they came. We have the literary prophets. And there were other prophets who were not literary prophets who came along. Some of them they slew. Some of them they tormented horribly. Some of them were sawn asunder, we're told in the scriptures. Some of them were beaten. Some of them were killed with a sword. And they were punished in many different ways. Not all of them were killed, but many of them were rejected and refused and tormented as a result of the terrible things which they had done. Jerusalem and the nation of Israel, which it served as the capital of, had disobeyed God and turned away from Him. The ultimate end was God destroyed Jerusalem in 586 B.C., He destroyed the city. And the reason He destroyed the city was because of idolatry and their turning away from their service to Him. But after 70 years, they repented in heart and returned unto the Lord, and He restored them to their land. So in 516 B.C., a group of people who had returned to the land of Palestine from the Babylonian captivity built again the temple in the city of Jerusalem. And after a number of years, rebuilt the city itself and the walls around it. So the city became a prominent city again. Under Solomon, this city had been a very prominent city. It had been a wealthy city. But all of that had been destroyed, but now as it comes back and they're rebuilding it again, it begins to take on a new shape again. It's slow, but eventually it happens. It takes a man by the name of Herod the Great to really restore it back to its former prominence, wealth, and place in society. But Herod the Great, who was a wicked king, a king of the Jews, wanted to restore the city, so he began by restoring building his palaces there, building other things of interest, and then finally by rebuilding and remodeling the temple in the city of Jerusalem. By the time of the Lord, when he was here upon earth, Jerusalem had regained its prominence, its place, and its position in the world. It was one of the most important cities in the world in Jesus' day and in the years thereafter. In fact, both the man who destroyed it and the historian who wrote about it tells us that it was one of the most prominent cities in the world. And there are those today who still think that in the day before it was destroyed, that Jerusalem made the greatest contribution to the world so far as learning and understanding of any city in the world at that particular time. So Jerusalem was an important city. Well, after the restoration of the nation of Israel to the land of Palestine from the Babylonian captivity, there was a change that took place in Israel. You see, before the captivity, the Israelites, for the most part, lived within the confines of Palestine. But then after the captivities, they were scattered into different sections. Not all Jews who were in Babylonian captivity returned to the land of Palestine. There were those who had gone down into Egypt and lived near Alexandria. There were many thousands, perhaps even millions of them, who lived in the vicinity of Alexandria. And then there were those who stayed in Babylon. Josephus tells us that there were three great centers of the Jews. There was the center in Babylon with many thousands and perhaps millions living there. In fact, it may have been the strongest group of Jews during the days of the Lord. And then there is those who lived in Palestine. And then there were those who lived in Egypt. Of all of those groups, the one who lived in Babylon were the most influential so far as the affairs of the Jews were concerned and did much to control the affairs of the nation of Israel from Babylon. Also, another thing that has to be remembered is that the Jews in these sections actually scattered into all the communities of the world. Josephus writes that there was not a city upon the face of the earth that had not admitted that tribe to their inhabitants. So the Jews had scattered into all regions throughout the world. So this was a change that took place. And it became also a powerful and rich city. You see, the Jews who were scattered throughout the world continued to send their tithes to Jerusalem. That amounted to a lot of money because there were millions of Jews. The estimates run high as to how many millions of Jews there were. And these sending their tithes each year up to Jerusalem caused the city to be a very rich and famous city. And so far as the Jews were concerned, it was the most important city in the world. And they talked to people about it. They were thrilled to be associated with a nation that had a city such as Jerusalem. And so they talked to others about it. This was an important city. But you remember, as we pointed out, that God said, if the nation of Israel does not keep my covenant and keep my commandments, they will be destroyed. And there are numerous Old Testament prophecies which point to the fact that these things would be eventually fulfilled. I want to call your attention quickly to some Old Testament passages. There are many, but to some Old Testament passages which shows that God intended to bring the nation of Israel with its capital, Jerusalem, to an end. Isaiah 65. In verse 6 he says, behold, it is written before me, I will not keep silence, but will recompense, even recompense into their bosom. Where was that written? In chapters 28 through 32 of Deuteronomy, God said that he would recompense it into their bosom because if they turned from him, they would have to suffer the consequences of it. He goes ahead to say, your iniquities and your iniquities of your fathers together, saith the Lord, which have burned incense upon the mountains and blasphemed me upon the hills. Therefore will I measure their former work into their bosom. They'll have to pay the price. He goes ahead to point out, though, that out of this nation that God had promised Abraham, would come a deliverer. Let me read verses 8 and 9. Thus saith the Lord, as the new wine is found in the cluster, and one saith, destroy it not. for a blessing is in it, so will I do for my servant's sake, that I may not destroy them all. And I will bring forth a seed out of Jacob and out of Judah, an inheritor of my mountains, and mine elect shall inherit it, and my servants shall dwell there. What are you going to do? He said, I am going to bring forth a seed out of Jacob, out of this nation. That seed they was referring to was Jesus Christ. And out of this nation that seed came and brought into existence the new covenant era that we will be talking more about. Then in verse 11 he says, but ye are they that forsake the Lord and forget my holy mountain, that prepare a table for that troop and that furnisheth the drink offering unto that number. Therefore will I number you to the sword, and ye shall bow down to the slaughter, because when I called, you did not answer. When I spake, you did not hear, but did evil before mine eyes, and did choose that wherein I delighted not. What's God going to do? He's going to destroy these people. And as we come on down to the chapter, I think that we find something very interesting as we look at verse 17. He continues to talk about the fact that he would destroy his people, those who rejected him, but that he would be with those who abided by his will. In verse 17 he says, for behold, I create new heavens and a new earth, and the former shall not be remembered nor come into mind. But be ye glad and rejoice, for even in that which I create, for behold, I create Jerusalem a rejoicing, and her people a joy. What's he talking about in this passage? He said, I'm going to destroy old Jerusalem, but when I do, I'm also going to build and to create a new heaven, a new earth, a new order of things, and there will be a new, different, spiritual Jerusalem. And this new, different, spiritual Jerusalem will replace the old Jerusalem. So in essence, what he's saying in this passage is that the nation of Israel, with Jerusalem as her capital, is doomed. But there will be the creation of a new heaven and a new earth. Not a literal new heaven and new earth, but a new spiritual order of things, in which there will come forth from that a new created Jerusalem. Then, if you will, turn with me right quickly to the 9th chapter of the book of Daniel. And you'll notice beginning in verse 24, he says, 70 weeks are determined upon thy people and the holy city. The holy city is Jerusalem. The reason is to finish the transgression and to make an end of sins and to make reconciliation for iniquity and to bring in everlasting righteousness and to seal up the vision and prophecy and to anoint the most holy. Know therefore and understand that from the going forth of the commandment to restore and to build Jerusalem unto the Messiah the Prince shall be 7 weeks and 62 weeks. The streets shall be built again. You see, when Daniel wrote this, Jerusalem was a pile of ruins. He said the street will be built again, the wall, even in troublous times. And after 62 weeks shall Messiah be cut off, but not for himself. And the people of the Prince shall come and shall destroy the city, and the sanctuary and the end thereof shall be with a flood. And unto the end of the war desolations are determined. And he shall confirm the covenant with many for 1 week, and in the midst of the week he shall cause the sacrifice and the oblation to cease, and for the overspreading of abominations he shall make it desolate, even till the consummation and that determined shall be poured out upon the desolate. Now, I do not need to explain this text, because surely you can understand that he's talking about what happened to this city in the year 70 A.D. It's the holy city. It's the city of Jerusalem, the holy city that we talked about previously. And he says this city is going to be destroyed, wiped out as vengeance from God because of their disobedience to him. Now, an explanation of this is found in the commentary, and if you would like to read further concerning that, then we would advise you to get the commentary in order that you can read more about that. Again, in Zechariah chapter 14, it says, beginning in verse 1, behold, the day of the Lord cometh, and thy spoil shall be divided in the midst of thee. And I will gather all nations against Jerusalem to battle, and the city shall be taken, and the houses raffled, and the women ravished, and half of the city shall go forth into captivity, and the residue of the people shall not be cut off from the city. He goes ahead to make it clear that in the day when this would take place, that the new covenant order would be in effect, and that the new Jerusalem would be built in verse 11, and pointing out that all of these things would be accomplished at that particular time. But you notice the fact that he's going to gather it against this city. The time that he did it was in 70 A.D. when he wiped the city out. The Lord is not silent concerning what's going to happen to the city of Jerusalem during his personal ministry either. We talked about some of those passages just a while ago, and we'll talk about just briefly some other of these passages. If you'll turn to the 22nd chapter of Matthew, the kingdom of heaven is likened to a certain king which made a marriage for his son. He bid the ones who were invited to come, and they began to make excuse and wouldn't come. And so what did he do? It says that in verse 7, and when the king heard thereof, he was wroth. And he sent forth his armies and destroyed those murderers and burned up their city. What's the message? He had sent his prophets and he had sent his servants to the nation of Israel. They had refused and rejected him. The end result was going to be that God would be wroth with them and that he would destroy those miserable servants and he would burn up their city, which is precisely what he did. Now, we'll not discuss other passages that deal with this, but I would like to call your attention to the fact that they exist. Luke 13, 1 through 9. Luke 19, 41 through 44. Matthew chapter 24. Mark chapter 13. And Luke 21, 5 through 36. Those three passages deal with the discourse of Jesus from the Mount of Olives on his last full day in Jerusalem before his betrayal and crucifixion. And in these passages, Jesus foretold in graphic detail the destruction of Jerusalem and the signs that would precede the destruction of the city. So the destruction of the city of Jerusalem was a thing foretold in Old Testament prophecy. It's a thing foretold by Jesus during his personal ministry. It's a thing that is also kept before the disciples after the day of Pentecost, as they talk about it on numerous occasions. In Acts 3, 19 through 21, it seems to be the subject matter on Peter's mind in that particular passage. In Acts 6, chapter 6, verses 13 and 14, it seems to be on Stephen's mind as he defends himself before the council. In chapter 13, 40 and 41, the Apostle Paul reminds the Jews in Galatia of what's about to happen. In writing the book of Romans, in Romans 9, 19 through 24, and 27 and 28, it is apparent that the Apostle Paul is anticipating the fact that the city of Jerusalem is going to be destroyed. I think it is rather unique that in the Old Testament scriptures, God used a number of the prophets to foretell what was going to happen so far as the city of Jerusalem was concerned, which led up to its first destruction in 586. Should it be considered a thing strange that God would use one New Testament book, a book of prophecy, to foretell what is going to happen in the destruction of Jerusalem and its final destruction? And is this not especially noteworthy, since the final destruction of Jerusalem in 70 A.D. was far more important and consequential than was the destruction of Jerusalem in 586. So we have established then, I think, according to these things, that the mystery of God, according to the Old Testament prophets, involved teaching concerning what was going to happen with the city of Jerusalem. There is no way that we can understand the book of Daniel without taking those things into consideration. And the writer of the Apocalypse says in chapter 10 in verse 7 that when the seventh angel sounds his trumpet, that the mystery that was revealed by God's servants, the prophets, will have been fulfilled, will have been finished, will have been accomplished. Now, in just a few moments, I want to present for you the background, the historical background in which the events that were foretold in the Old Testament, that were foretold by Jesus during his personal ministry, that were foretold by the apostles and evangelists of the New Covenant in the New Testament, when in relationship to history, these things were fulfilled. Let me suggest to you that according to Daniel, these things were to be accomplished by the Roman Empire. These things were to take place under the Roman emperors. Now, in the course of our study, we have used this chart before, but I want to use it again to give the background for the war that developed against the Jews. It was during the reign of Nero Caesar that things grew very, very bad. They had been bad before that time, but they grew worse during this period of time. And there were wars and rumors of wars, and the people began to say, we cannot serve Rome any longer. We cannot be under their dominion. And there were those who were wanting to be for Rome, afraid that if they rebelled against Rome, they would be annihilated. And so this led, so far as the Romans were concerned, from that standpoint, to the war that resulted in their utter destruction. There was the president of Syria who saw some of the disturbances that were taking place in Judea, who went up to Jerusalem with an army, and in the year 66 A.D. surrounded the city and would have taken it, except, as Josephus says, had it not been for an aversion from God. He would have taken it, but instead he backed off from the city, and the city was spared destruction at this particular time. So the Romans are involved, so far as the city is concerned, in fulfillment of the Old Testament prophets concerning it. But also involved, so far as that is concerned, are the Jews who inhabit Palestine. You see, when the disturbances arise with the Romans, it is evident, so far as the Jews are concerned, that a war with the Romans cannot be avoided. And so they make their attempts to prepare for war. And so they select certain individuals to direct the peoples, the nation of Israel, against the war that is developing. They select a man by the name of Josephus to guide the armies in Galilee. He selects an army of about 120,000 men. He trains them, and then he has about 60,000 men left. And the Romans have selected a man by the name of Vespasian, who later became an emperor. And he goes up there with an army at the direction of Nero to prepare for the war. And so he comes into that region and making preparations for it, while the Jews are making their preparation for the war as well. And so the war develops somewhat on this fashion. Vespasian comes into this region up here, and with his army he fights against Galilee and this region up here and the armies of Josephus, and in a short period of time he has conquered these. This happens in the year 67, approximately 1 year after the president of Syria, Cestius Gallus, has fought against Jerusalem and been defeated. But this time he comes, Vespasian comes with his army of 60,000 men and fights against Galilee and conquers it. And after that, he fights against the navy of the Jews at Joppa, and he destroys it. And then after some period of time, he takes his armies into this region over here and conquers it, and then conquers all of this region north of Jerusalem. And all of that is in conquest. So this is the development of the war as it took place During that time. Ultimately, Nero dies. Vespasian replaces him after a few months as the emperor of the empire. He sends back his son with an army in excess of 60,000 who goes up and lays siege to the city of Jerusalem. And after a period of 5 months, that city is wiped out and destroyed with the inhabitants that are in it, destroyed with it, with the exception of those who were taken as captives. These things took place in 70 A.D., a period of 5 months. It was under siege, and war was terrible. One would do well to read the history of Josephus and to see what all is said about it. But all that God had promised and foretold in the Old Testament scriptures was brought to complete fruition in 70 A.D. when the armies of Titus and the Romans surrounded the city and besieged it 5 months and destroyed it. Indeed, when the seventh angel sounded his trumpet, the mysteries of God as spoken by His servants the prophets have been accomplished and fulfilled. You can count on that as being accurate from the teaching of the Scriptures.